Well, we're at a bit of a disadvantage for Unit 4 compared to my Tuesday-Thursday section because Monday holidays means you have fewer meetings, so I have to squeeze this into one fewer lecture. I therefore will be using every minute of these next several meetings. But we're opening up Unit 4 with a chapter about the cell cycle, which is basically everything that happens within the lifetime of a single cell from the time it's created to the time that it, if it doesn't die or get killed, till the time it splits into two new cells. And therefore, part of the cell cycle is cell division. And we'll talk about the details of cell division in a minute, but this opening slide shows you three major functions of cell division. First of which, as you see, is reproduction. This actually applies to both unicellular and multicellular organisms. A unicellular organism reproduces by cell division, and it's a little bit different from how a human, for instance, does it. Nowadays, a woman usually survives the process of giving birth, but she still exists. But a unicellular organism, when it reproduces, splits into two new cells that replace the original cell. The original organism is no longer there. It's replaced by two new cells. So that involves cell division. But it also involves cell division when we're talking about multicellular organisms. You started out as a single cell, a zygote, and then before birth, you were already many, many millions of cells because new cells were created by cell division. Growth and development are in the middle, lumped together, even though they're separate things. Growth is increase in size. Even individual cells grow, because when a cell divides into two, at least right away, of course, those two cells are not going to be as big as the original cell. They're going to be roughly half as big. So cells grow, but really, as far as cell division is concerned, growth here refers to multicellular organisms. Huge organisms like us and things even bigger than us are not huge because the cell is huge. As we talked about, there's a constraint put on cell size by the surface area to volume ratio. So instead, huge organisms get huge by adding more and more cells to their body, which involves cell division to create those cells. Development refers to changes along the way. So you are not just 100 trillion copies of that zygote you started out as. You have developed along the way, so you have many different kinds of cells, neurons, muscle cells, and so on. Tissue renewal, obviously, hopefully it's obvious that that really applies only to multicellular organisms because only multicellular organisms have tissues. Remember where tissues lies in the hierarchy of biological organization. It's above cells and below organs, right? Tissues are collections of cells specializing for a purpose. And tissue renewal refers to healing. You know, if you injure yourself, even a small injury is going to kill millions of cells in that tissue. But you heal, hopefully, and that really involves the surviving cells in the area, the ones that didn't get killed, are spurred into dividing to create new cells to replace the ones that were killed. Okay, slide 2. This is a photomicrograph of a cell, and it should be obvious to you that this is a eukaryotic cell because we clearly see a nucleus, right? This is a true nucleus. It is membrane-bounded. And inside the nucleus is material that you see as purple strands here. I can tell by looking at this that this is a cell that's close to the end of its own lifetime. For most of the lifetime of a cell, if you saw the nucleus under a light microscope, you wouldn't see really any detail inside it like you see here. It would just be a gray background all the same. The material that's in here that we see as these purplish strands is called chromatin. And chromatin is a mixture, molecularly speaking. Chromatin contains DNA and proteins. And we'll talk much more about chromatin eventually, but chromatin is the material that chromosomes are made out of. But we don't use the word chromosomes until we see them as individual entities. And we don't right here, right? We don't have any idea how many chromosomes there are. It's the same material that's here that was there before when I said you wouldn't see this detail. The chromatin is there, but during most of the lifetime of the cell, the chromatin is loosely arranged, which is why you don't see chromosomes. When a cell gets close to the time at which it's going to divide, it first condenses its chromatin tightly, and there are several different pieces of it. When those pieces get small enough so that we can tell them apart from each other, that's when we use the word chromosome. It's still the same material. But a chromosome is a highly condensed form of chromatin. And that's why I said I can tell that this cell's getting ready to end its own life, which means it's getting ready to divide to create two new cells to replace it. So let's look at slide 3 at an individual chromosome. That's what's shown in the photomicrograph on the left edge. This is just one of some number of chromosomes that the cell would have, the cell this was taken from. The number of chromosomes is typical for a species, but it depends on the species. So humans, for instance, have 23 different kinds of chromosomes. Other species have more, other species have fewer than we do. The number depends on the species. So this is just one in isolation. And more specifically than saying that this is a chromosome, it is a replicated chromosome. So think back to the two major functions of DNA that we talked about early in the term. Remember, those were replication and transcription. Replication is necessary because cells come from pre-existing cells when cells split. That's how new cells are created. A cell has to split into two to create cells. And if you think about this process of cell division, if you're a cell, you need your DNA, of course. If you're going to split into two cells that are viable, which means they have a chance of surviving, not only does each of those cells need DNA of its own, each of those cells needs all of the DNA that the original cell had. You can't have just part of the DNA library. You have to have all of it. So the only way this cell division process can work for the cells, the two cells created to live, is to first, before splitting, make a copy of the entire library of DNA. That's where DNA replication comes in, one of the two major functions of DNA. And that's already happened here. I can tell this is a replicated chromosome because it's made of two halves, a right and left half, that are chromatin. So there's DNA and proteins here. But as far as the DNA, which is indicated on the right side, just as these helical shapes, the DNA part of this right half is identical to the DNA part in the left half of this replicated chromosome because of DNA replication. DNA replication makes exact copies. And we call this one chromosome, even though it's enough information for two chromosomes, and it eventually will be two on their own after the two halves split. But we consider it to be one replicated chromosome when the two identical copies are hooked together. Each copy, which is half of this replicated chromosome, is called a chromatid. They are sister chromatids because they're copies of each other. Sister has nothing to do with gender or anything. That's just what they call it. And the position at which these two sister chromatids are hooked is called the centromere. And the centromere is somewhere along the length. It depends on the chromosome. It's not always right here at about 60% along the length. It depends. But that's a replicated chromosome. And a cell has to replicate its chromosomes before it can split, like I was saying, so that when it does split, each of the two daughter cells, as they're called, once again, nothing having to do with gender, will receive one half of this replicated chromosome. A chromatin will split from the other chromatin, and it's attached, chromatid it's attached to, and at that point, we actually don't call them chromatids anymore. Then they are chromosomes in their own right, only they're unreplicated. They're just enough for one cell. Each cell will get one of the copies. Okay, four. This is a schematic representation of one cell cycle. And when I say cell cycle for this chapter, I'm talking about cell cycle of a eukaryotic cell. The cell cycle, which is the full lifetime of a eukaryotic cell, involves two major subdivisions. The entire thing is the cell cycle. But there are two major subdivisions shown in teal, one of which is interphase, and then in yellow here, the second major subdivision of the cell cycle is the so-called mitotic phase, or just M phase for short. I want you to be careful with that phrase, though. Mitotic is just the adjective of mitosis, but the mitotic phase is not another name for mitosis. Okay, mitotic phase includes mitosis, but more than mitosis. The mitotic phase, as you see, is made up of mitosis and cytokinesis. All right, but the two major subdivisions of the cell cycle are interphase, which is the majority of the time that the cell will spend in, followed by the mitotic phase. Now, the mitotic phase is the part of the cell cycle known as cell division for a eukaryotic cell. All right, now I'll get back to that. Let me go in the order in which it happens. Interphase is the first major subdivision, but as you see here, interphase itself is divided into three subphases. And in order, those are G1, S, and G2. Now the G's here stand for gap. So first gap, S, and then second gap. That's really a misnomer, because calling it a gap implies that nothing is happening. Well, they named it that because when you look at a cell in G1 or in G2 under a light microscope, it seems like nothing's happening, but of course a lot of things are happening. So, but anyway, that's what the G's stand for. G1 is really the normal lifetime of whatever kind of cell that is. For whatever organism, whatever eukaryotic organism. But if you think about it as one of your own cells, the cell spends G1 doing whatever that kind of cell does. Like if it's a liver cell, it's doing liver cell stuff. It's using its DNA throughout G1 for the other purpose that DNA serves, besides replication, which is transcription. And we haven't looked at the particulars of transcription yet, but you should already know that transcription involves reading the DNA code to make RNA, which then can be read by the cell to make proteins. So the other job besides replication of DNA, which is transcription, is a way to indirectly instruct the cell how to make the proteins that the cell needs. And proteins are used for all functions within cells. Okay, so that's what G1's all about. It's busy living its life, doing whatever that type of cell does, using its genes to indirectly make the proteins it needs. Eventually, though, it might get to a point where it's going to make the decision to prepare to end its own life, in a sense, by splitting into two new cells. And that's what brings us to the S phase, the second subphase of interphase. S here stands for synthesis of DNA. So the S phase is when the other function of DNA occurs, which is replication. All right, so when the when the decision is made, okay, I've lived my life, I'm going to start to split, like I said earlier, that won't work unless before splitting the entire DNA library is copied. That's what that happens in the S phase. And then G2 follows that. Well, there's still a lot of things happening there. There's still a lot of transcription of genes occurring in there. It's just that this is spent, most of the genes that are used in here and the proteins produced from them are for the purpose of preparing for cell division rather than living its normal lifetime. All right, so those three together are interphase. Then at the end of G2, the preparation is complete for cell division, and the mitotic phase is actual cell division. But unlike a prokaryote, remember this is a eukaryotic cell we're looking at, unlike a prokaryote, a eukaryotic cell is compartmentalized because of its membrane-bounded organelles. And there are two major compartments within a eukaryotic cell. We've talked about this before, which is the nucleus itself and then everything else, which collectively could be called cytoplasm. If a eukaryotic cell is going to divide, therefore, it needs to divide both of these compartments. So cell division is the overall process, but the two components of that are mitosis, which is division of the nucleus and its contents, accompanied by the other part of cell division, which is cytokinesis. Cytokinesis is the division of everything other than the nucleus, division of the cytoplasm. Well, when you look at this figure, there are stark black lines between G1 and S and S and G2 and so on. But there's no black line between mitosis and cytokinesis, and it kind of fades from one yellow to another yellow here. That's not an artistic mistake. That is there to indicate that mitosis starts first in cell division, but cytokinesis doesn't wait for mitosis to end before it starts. They overlap in time. So mitosis starts, cytokinesis starts later, but before mitosis is done. And when they both happen together, the result is two completely independent cells. The original cell is no longer there. That's why you see two cells coming off of here. Each brand new cell will then enter its own cell cycle for another trip. How long it takes drastically varies. It depends on the type of cell. But the stages are the same, named the same. Okay, so I'm going to take a closer look at mitosis. Well, more than mitosis, cell division, which is mitosis and cytokinesis, in slide 5. But even more than that is shown here, because notice on the left column we have G2 of interphase. So this is before the mitotic phase. This is the end of interphase, G2, right? Which we just looked at. And each of these columns shows you a real photomicrograph that's been colorized and a corresponding cartoon. The photographs are real, but the cartoons are easier to look at to understand what's happening in each of these subphases. Okay, so this is not yet mitosis. This is how things are right before mitosis. Then the next 5 are the 5 subphases of mitosis. Mitosis is already a subphase of the mitotic phase, remember, in the overall cell cycle. And then not shown in that previous slide is the fact that mitosis itself has 5 subdivisions, 5 subphases, which are in order called prophase, prometaphase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. And you can tell them apart based on what's happening differently in each of these subphases. But first, let's look at what's the situation in G2 before mitosis so that we can compare that. We can compare the mitotic phases to that. At the end of G2, or in late G2, what we have here is a nucleus that contains chromatin. There's not much detail shown in here, but there's more detail than you would see in G1. G1, you would just see a plain purple background because the chromatin would be nice and loose. Here you can see that in late G2, the chromatin is starting to condense. It's starting to coil up tighter and tighter. All right, now the reason that does this is because it would be a tangled mess if you tried to divide all this chromatin into two halves when it's loose. So the condensing of chromatin occurs in preparation for cell division just to keep things from being a tangled mess. All right? But both of those functions of DNA, transcription or replication, either one of those, in order for it to happen, requires reading the sequence of nucleotides. In other words, the code that's in DNA. And the only way that the cell can get in there and read DNA is if the chromatin is nice and loose. That's why it's loose for most of the cell cycle. When it comes time, though, to prepare for dividing, it needs to coil it up tightly, and that's when we eventually, when it's tight enough so that we see separate pieces, that's when we use the word chromosomes. That hasn't happened yet here, but we can see that some chromatin condensing has occurred. Also, the nuclear envelope is still intact in G2. Out in the cytoplasm, we have two centrosomes. Now, this is an animal cell. You can tell that because its centrosomes have centrioles. Remember, we talked about these T-shaped pairs of proteins that are called centrioles that I told you we don't know what they do. It's just that animal cell centrosomes have them and others don't. Well, earlier in the cell cycle, before the S phase, if this were G1, and it's not, it's G2. If it were G1, there would only be one centrosome. So even though the S phase is named for DNA synthesis, that's when replication occurred, and that has already occurred by the time we got here. The S phase also involves replication of the centrosome. That's why there's now two here. All right? But they're out in the cytoplasm. All right, that's the state of affairs when you enter the mitotic phase, and the first part of the mitotic phase is mitosis, and the first part of mitosis is prophase. So let's see what's happening here. As far as the centrosomes are concerned, out in the cytoplasm, well, keep in mind what centrosomes are. They are microtubule organizing centers. Remember, this is from the Survey of the Cell chapter. They are the places from which microtubules grow and get longer, and that's occurring here. Microtubules are growing from each of these two centrosomes, and those microtubules, as they get longer and longer, are pushing on each other from the opposite centrosomes. This is causing polarization of the centrosomes. Polarization simply refers here to the fact that the centrosomes are moving to opposite ends of the cell. They haven't gotten there quite there yet, but they're on their way because of these microtubules pushing on each other. So that's one aspect of prophase. Now the nucleus. Well, notice that the nuclear envelope is still intact like it was in G2. So no change with the membrane. But inside the nucleus, notice that the chromatin has gotten much more compacted or condensed. So much so that we can't yet tell how many pieces there are, but we can definitely see that they are being distinct pieces, or becoming distinct pieces compared to G2. So they're getting close to being called chromosomes, right? Even though it's really the same material, just more condensed. Next in line is prometaphase. And a couple of important things have happened here. The polarization of the centrosomes is complete. Each centrosome is at an opposite end compared to the other. Now, the two centrosomes, along with the microtubules that are growing from them, collectively those make up what are called the mitotic spindle. It's a spindle used for the purpose of mitosis. That's why it's called that. A spindle, by the way, something that's spindle-shaped, is tapered at the ends and wider in the middle, football-shaped, so to speak, like this mitotic spindle in yellow here. Okay, now, the mitotic spindle includes the centrosomes and the microtubules. And all microtubules molecularly are the same. They're made up of the same polymer. But there are two functional categories of microtubules making up the spindle. One category of microtubules are called kinetochore microtubules. And the other can either be called non-kinetochore microtubules or polar microtubules. Those non-kinetochore microtubules and polar microtubules mean the same thing. Here's the difference, though. They're made of the same stuff, but they're doing different things. The non-kinetochore microtubules are the ones that are pushing on each other, or were already pushing on each other in prophase, and have fully polarized the mitotic spindle. They're called non-kinetochore microtubules because they are not connected to things that are called kinetochores. The other microtubules in the spindle, though, the kinetochore microtubules, do connect to kinetochores. So what are kinetochores? Well, kinetochores are protein complexes located on replicated chromosomes. All right? So those replicated chromosomes are, of course, inside the nucleus. And that's a problem for most eukaryotic cells because the spindle is out in the cytoplasm. That's where the non-kinetochore microtubules are growing. The kinetochore microtubules are growing. And they need to connect to kinetochores that are on chromosomes that are inside the nucleus. Therefore, the nuclear envelope is in the way. It's a barrier. That's why it needs to be gotten rid of. So a hallmark of prometaphase is that the nuclear envelope disintegrates to allow for attachment of kinetochore microtubules to kinetochores on replicated chromosomes. The kinetochores in this picture are these little black dots. There's two kinetochores for each replicated chromosome because there's one kinetochore for each sister chromatid. That's one half of the replicated chromosome. Also, an important thing that's happened is that the condensing of the chromosomes has continued beyond what it was in prophase. Now we can definitely tell that there are individual chunks here. That's when we start properly using the term chromosomes. Each of these is a replicated chromosome. You can tell it distinctly from the others. And each one, as a replicated chromosome would be, consists of two sister chromatids. All right, so the kinetochore microtubules are connecting to these kinetochores. And they're doing that in such a way that a kinetochore microtubule growing from one pole, one centrosome, is connected to the kinetochore, to one of the kinetochores on the replicated chromosome. And the other kinetochore on that same replicated chromosome is being attached by a kinetochore microtubule coming from the other centrosome. All right, that's prometaphase. Next is metaphase, which is the shortest of the phases because it is really just defined as the short time during which all of these replicated chromosomes are positioned halfway between the two poles. And it kind of looks like they're lined up end to end, but that's not necessarily true. Because this is really a three-dimensional thing, right? It's a globe, not a circle. And so halfway between the two poles is not a line, but a plane in two dimensions. And we call that plane either the metaphase plate or the equatorial plane. It's an imaginary plane, though. It's not an actual device, not a structure. But anyway, these chromosomes can be anywhere in that plane. They don't have to be lined up. Anywhere in that plane, though, we'll put them halfway between the two poles. Now, the reason that they're able to attain this halfway position is because, in the previous step, prometaphase, the attachments were made between the kinetochore microtubules of the spindle and the kinetochores of the replicated chromosomes. Once the connections are made, then the chromosomes can be moved to where they need to be, halfway between the poles. That is metaphase. Notice up to this point, nothing has split, even though we're in a process called cell division. That's about to change, though, because the next phase of mitosis is anaphase. And anaphase is the subphase of mitosis during which a splitting occurs. And notice what's splitting apart here. In anaphase of mitosis, the two identical, genetically identical, sister chromatids making up each replicated chromosome are separating from each other. They were joined at the centromere. Now they're not joined anymore. And as soon as they're not joined, we stop calling them chromatids. Now each one is a chromosome, enough information for a chromosome for one cell. The other one is going to go into a different cell. Okay, so we call them daughter chromosomes at this point. They are not replicated chromosomes. They are just one cell's worth. The replicated chromosomes before them were enough for two cells. Okay, not only do they split, but these resulting daughter chromosomes get moved closer and closer to one pole or the other, depending on which pole they're associated with through the microtubule, the kinetic or microtubule that joins them. That is anaphase. The final part of mitosis is just half of this picture, which is telophase. Telophase is involving only what's happening to the chromosomes, the nuclear contents, because that's what mitosis is about. Cytokinesis is shown here also, but that's a different part of cell division. It's not part of mitosis. Anyway, when the daughter chromosomes actually reach their destination, one pole or the other, that is telophase. And another thing that happens is that that collection of daughter chromosomes that go to one pole are going to form, are going to be the contents of a new nucleus. And then another nucleus is going to be formed at the other pole. So nuclear envelopes get created. And at the moment, since this is still one cell, it's going to have two nuclei. But it's not going to remain as one cell. It's going to split into two. Anyway, there's two new nuclei formed with their own membranes. And notice that the chromosomes have already started to loosen up. And that's because of what I told you earlier. In order to use the genes that are in those chromosomes, they need to be accessible. They need to have their codes read, so the chromatin needs to be looser. That's what's happening here. They're not nearly as small as they were here. I should have mentioned, back in metaphase, that that's the place where the condensing of chromatin is maximized. These are as small as chromosomes ever will be for this species. All right, so that's telophase, and therefore that's the end of mitosis. But when I was talking about the yellow fading into the other yellow, you see that here. Cytokinesis is starting even though mitosis is not yet complete. There's an overlap. But the cytokinesis part of eukaryotic cell division involves the splitting of the cytoplasm. And in an animal cell, which is what we're looking at, that involves the formation of what's called a cleavage furrow, which is a ditch. To cleave is to split apart. And that cleavage furrow gets deeper and deeper all the way around until eventually it will pinch off. And when it pinches off, that's the end of cell division and the end of the cell cycle, because now you have two brand new cells. The original cell is no longer there. All right, six. This is just a close-up, specifically of mitosis, a metaphase of mitosis. And the book here shows you the metaphase plate that I named earlier. It shows it as a piece of glass. It's not an actual structure. It's an imaginary plane. But it gives you more of a 3D feel for what I was talking about before. The chromosomes aren't lined up. They're just anywhere within that metaphase plate, which is halfway between the poles. And you get a much better view of the kinetochores themselves. Each replicated chromosome consists of two sister chromatids, and each chromatid features its own kinetochore, which is the place where the kinetochore microtubules of the spindle attach. One from one pole, and the other kinetochore is attached by a kinetochore microtubule from the other pole. All right. So that is what happens. We can observe that, or we did, or I wasn't alive, but someone observed it originally, and that's just what happens. The question is, though, how does it happen? Well, there could be any number of hypotheses, and by how it happens, I'm specifically in slide 7 talking about how does anaphase happen, which is where the splitting and the migration of the splitting of the chromatids occurs and the migration of those daughter chromosomes to opposite poles. Well, two possibilities that make sense, if you're just guessing, would be, well, one of the two possibilities would be a kind of a fishing hypothesis, analogous to catching a fish with a hook and a line. In other words, the kinetochore microtubules are cast out like fishing lines and hook the daughter chromosomes, or hook the chromatids before they're split, and then once they're split, they're daughter chromosomes, but then reel them in, just like reeling in from the fishing rod, dragging the fish, in this case, dragging the daughter chromosome. That's one possibility. Another, though, is that after the attachments are made between the microtubules and the kinetochores, those daughter chromosomes use the microtubules as roadways to move along toward the pole. Well, those both make sense, and so they devised an experiment, which the results are shown here, to test which of these two predictions come true. And they marked the mitotic spindle with this black band. It's not really a black band, but they chemically marked it. It's analogous to taking a black marker and making that stripe. Now, if the fishing hypothesis were true, then what you would see is the mark itself would move closer and closer to the pole, because it would be like marking a part of the fishing line, right? It would get closer to the reel. And the distance, or the yellow region between the mark and the chromosomes, would stay the same, and everything would be reeled in. Well, that's not what actually happened. If the other hypothesis is true, and the microtubules are just roadways along which the chromosomes are moving, then you would expect the mark to stay in place because it's part of the road, and you would see the chromosomes approach the mark and then pass it. And that's exactly what they did observe. So it's not the reeling in hypothesis that's true. Instead, the microtubules are used as roadways, which should not surprise you because I've already told you that microtubules in other parts of the cell cycle serve as roadways, right? We talked about motor proteins moving vesicles of whatever cargo along microtubules. Well, if you look in the bottom at the detail of a kinetochore, each kinetochore includes motor proteins. And the motor proteins, just like other uses of motor proteins, walk one step at a time along these microtubules, dragging the chromosome along. Now, what made it look to them like it might be reeling it in like a fishing line is that these particular roadways, these microtubules that are part of the mitotic spindle, yes, they're roads, but they're unlike most roads. Most roads are used over and over. This is a road, though. Each one of these is a road that's going to be used exactly one time just for this trip. And as soon as the daughter chromosome moves past some distance on the road behind it is no longer useful. It's never going to be used again. So the cell dismantles it and recycles the material. These tubulin subunits, those are just the monomers of the polymer that makes up the microtubule itself. So, yes, the road gets shorter, but not because it's being reeled in. It's because it's being destroyed after it's used. Okay, 8. Those were the particulars, mostly we talked about mitosis, but that's just part of cell division in a eukaryote, remember. Cytokinesis is also part of it. And in the left half, we see animal cytokinesis and compare it in the right to plant cytokinesis. They happen a little bit differently, but first let's look at greater detail of animal cytokinesis. I told you that a cleavage furrow forms. This is showing you how that happens. It's kind of a drawstring technique, or kind of like a belt, which is really kind of like a drawstring. But a typical belt is worn on the outside of pants, right? And it goes through belt loops. Well, there are belt loops, but they are inside the cell, not outside. So these little lines are protein complexes that are more or less belt loops. The belt itself is a microfilament. We've talked about microfilaments before. Those are the cytoskeletal elements that are important in your skeletal muscles, for instance. They allow your muscles to shorten, remember, because they overlap with each other. Well, the belt is made out of microfilament, and it, to complete the loop, it overlaps with itself. If you continue to overlap it more and more, you're making the circle smaller and smaller, tightening up the belt. And since that belt is through those inner belt loops, it's going to collapse the entire cell, creating this cleavage furrow. And it'll get deeper and deeper until it actually pinches off. That works for animal cells because animal cells have only a plasma membrane, which is flimsy. Plant cells, of course, like any cell, has a plasma membrane. But in addition to that, as we've talked about, the plant cell has a much thicker and stronger cell wall exterior to that. And so the cell wall is much too thick and strong to allow for a cleavage furrow to develop. Therefore, plants have to undergo cytokinesis a little bit differently. What happens here is that, well, first of all, in this plant cell, mitosis has already gone to almost completion. You have two, if not completion, these two nuclei have been created because telophase created them. That's the end of mitosis. And this halfway point, the vertical line here, which would really be a plane, would be the metaphase plate I was talking about, halfway between the poles. At that metaphase plate in a plant cell, several different vesicles develop. Just like vesicles I've talked about before, vesicles are made out of membrane material. That's what makes the sac. And the contents, in this case, of the vesicles is cell wall material. All right. Many of these are developing, and they're all getting bigger, which means they're growing toward each other, and eventually they'll kiss each other, basically, and since they're enclosed by membrane, the membranes will fuse, just like in exocytosis or endocytosis, and that will create one long thing called the cell plate. Cell plate has cell wall material inside it, but it's surrounded by membrane material. It will continue to elongate as more and more cell wall material is added until eventually the ends of it fuse with the sides of the inside of the cell where the plasma membrane is. And at that point, you officially now have two cells because this part of the membrane that was on the cell plate is now part of this plasma membrane, similarly over here. And in between the two cells is the cell wall material that the vesicles originally contained. These two new plant cells can then get bigger, but they are already distinct cells. Cell division is complete at this point. Slide 9 doesn't give you any new information. It just shows you pictures of mitosis for a plant cell. I'm not going to go through those things again because everything happens the same way in a plant as it does for an animal. This just shows you that we're not making up these cartoon pictures. It really looks like this. And you can see these examples of these when we look through real microscopes downstairs. The only difference really is that there wouldn't be any centrioles in this because it's a plant cell, but we don't know what those do anyway. Okay. 10. We've been talking about eukaryotic cell division, but all cells, I mean, cells of both types, prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells, are able to divide. It's just a bit simpler of process in a prokaryotic cell because they don't have that compartmentalization. And that what the mechanism by which most prokaryotic cells divide is called binary fission. Binary simply means into or involving two, and fission
means splitting.
A fissure is a split. So binary fission accomplishes the same thing that mitosis and cytokinesis does for a eukaryotic cell, but binary fission occurs in prokaryotic cells. Still, there's the same problem for a prokaryotic cell. Division won't work unless you first replicate the genome, which is the collection of all the DNA. And this brings up a difference, I don't know whether I've mentioned this before or not, difference between chromosomes in the two types of cells. And a eukaryotic cell has some number, which I told you depends on the species, some number of chromosomes, and the chromosomes are called linear chromosomes because each one has two ends. A prokaryotic cell, on the other hand, has one chromosome, and it is called a circular chromosome because it doesn't have any ends. It forms a loop. Now, it doesn't look like a loop here. It looks like a dish of spaghetti, but if you were to spread it out, it would make one loop. All right, that's the top picture. So in order to prepare for binary fission, this is a bacterium as a representative prokaryote, this bacterium has to first replicate its single chromosome. That's this middle picture. Notice there's twice as much spaghetti here. It's really two loops. Now it's ready for binary fission, and it really just involves the splitting of this cell into two. So we're skipping the molecular details of this and just leaving it at that. The name is binary fission. 11 compares binary fission at the top that we just talked about, along with mitosis on the bottom in most eukaryotes, which we've already talked about. We talked about it for animals and plants, but they're not the only eukaryotes, remember. There's all kinds of others, and most of those do it the same way as well. But then in B and C here, we have some groups of eukaryotes that do it a little bit differently. In dinoflagellates, for instance, there is no disintegration of the nuclear envelope because they don't have to bother with it, since the nuclear envelope has holes in it through which these microtubules can grow. So in other words, the nuclear envelope is not in the way for them. And it's not in the way for diatoms and yeasts in C either, because the centrosomes are, in these species, they're not out in the cytoplasm. The centrosomes are inside the nucleus, which is where the connections need to be made with the kinetochore. So they also don't have to disintegrate their nuclear envelopes. Well, that brings us to 12. We've talked about what happens in cell division in a eukaryote, but a major question, once you know the details, is how is this controlled? How does a cell know what part of the cell cycle it's in, or whether it's time to go to the next part of the cell cycle? Well, of course, an individual cell doesn't know anything, but there must be some sort of control of the cell cycle, and there is. It's reasonable, or it was before we knew what we know today, it was reasonable to assume that there is a chemical basis for the control of the cell cycle, which just is another word for a cell goes through the cell cycle or doesn't, depending on the chemical situation. So there are chemical signals that cause movement through the cell cycle from one phase to the other. Even though that makes perfect sense, you can't in science just say this is what things are because it makes sense. You have to actually demonstrate it. So that's what the experiment's results are shown in slide 12 are all about. This involves fusion of cells that are the same type of cell, but they are in different parts of the cell cycle. So first they fuse a cell that's in the S phase with a cell that's in G1. And remember, G1 is before S in the cell cycle. So this G1 cell is earlier in the cell cycle than this one. When they fuse them, though, what they notice, that the nucleus that was in the G1 cell immediately started replicating its chromosomes, or its chromatin. In other words, it behaved as though it's in S. So that's pretty good indication that there's a chemical basis. It seems that there's some sort of chemical in this S cell that gets exposed to the G cell and tells it you need to be in S. But there's much better evidence in the second experiment. Here they fused again, but this time they fused an M cell, which is at the end of the cell cycle, right? The M phase is cell division, with a G1 cell, which is at the very beginning of the cell cycle. So these are at opposite ends of the lifetime of a cell. And when they did that, the G1 nucleus immediately tried to undergo mitosis. It tried to split chromatids, even though it doesn't have two chromatids because it skipped over S. Remember that the chromatids get created, the new copy that becomes the second chromatid gets copied in the S phase. Well, it's skipping right over S and going straight to G. It skips S and G2 and goes right to M. And so it can't possibly successfully divide, but it thinks it's supposed to, and that's what's the good evidence here. Some chemical in the M phase cell is telling it, try to divide. That is a pretty good indication that there's a chemical basis that, of course, does not at all say what that chemical basis is or how it works. And so we'll talk a little bit about what we know about how it works. Starting in 13, the cell cycle is represented here by this, it looks like a timer, a lamp timer, with these red gates that can be either up or down, allowing passage from one point to the next. Well, these gates are called checkpoints. And unlike this analogy, a checkpoint in the cell is not an actual structure. What a checkpoint is in the cell cycle is simply a set of chemical conditions. In other words, the right kind of chemicals have to be present and at the right concentrations in order for a cell to go from one phase to the next through the checkpoint. And if that doesn't happen, there will be no progression to the next phase. It will stay within that phase it's in at the moment. So let's go to 14 and see by this analogy that if you think of it as gates, the gate is down here. It's getting the green light to go from G1 to S. That's an important checkpoint because that determines whether the cell is ready to prepare for ending its own life and splitting or not. But as I said, it's not really a gate. It's just the chemical conditions are correct for it to go to S. Now, that might take a long time. It might not take very long at all. It totally depends on the cell and the situation. For instance, in your body, skin cells get to the G1 checkpoint pretty easily because you lose billions of cells, skin cells, every day from your skin. Just the wind blowing on you gets rid of millions of cells. Those have to be replaced, of course, or you'd quickly run out of skin. So you're always building new skin cells by existing skin cells undergoing cell division, and that replaces the ones that get lost. On the other hand, a typical neuron, is going to last your entire lifetime, or it will die during your lifetime. A typical neuron never gets to the S phase. It never divides in your lifetime. And that can happen for various reasons for various cells, and we see that in the right half. This one never gets the green light. And we call that G0. It's really just G1, but permanent G1. Or if not permanent, it's indeterminately long G1. It's going to be in G1 until the conditions are met, which might never be met. Well, let's look at a little bit of the detail of what we know about how the chemical control of the cell cycle works. This is slide 15. And it involves, this slide involves two graphs. This is actually two graphs in one, a purple trace and, two purple traces, a darker purple and a lighter purple, but they have different Y values. Notice that one of them is MPF activity, so the higher up, the greater the MPF activity, which I'll explain in a minute. The other y-axis is concentration of something that's called cyclin. And notice here that we have two complete cell cycles and then the beginning of another. So this is not just one cell. This is the beginning of a cell, then it splits, and each cell goes through its own cell cycle and so on. But within one cell cycle, these y values differ. Things go up and down. Okay, now, on the bottom, we can see what's involved here chemically. We have a couple different proteins here. One in this lighter purple, labeled as CDK. And the darker purple is a different protein, labeled as cyclin. CDK, even though it's not all caps, is an acronym. And it stands for cyclin dependent kinase. So right away you know that it is what? It's an enzyme, right? Not only is it a protein, but it's a protein acting as an enzyme because of the ASE ending. Well, kinase is not a single enzyme. Kinase is a category, just like dehydrogenases is a category. We talked about dehydrogenases, but there's all kinds of different dehydrogenases. They all qualify as dehydrogenases because their purpose is to accelerate dehydrogenation reactions. Well, this is a different category called kinases. There's all kinds of kinases as well. This is just one. But what qualifies an enzyme as a kinase, if it is a kinase, is that its job is to phosphorylate something else. And we've talked about phosphorylation, and the opposite of that, remember, is dephosphorylation. We've talked about this multiple times. Phosphorylation and dephosphorylation refers to hooking a phosphate on, phosphorylation, and taking it off, dephosphorylation. Well, there's a different category of enzymes responsible for removing them. Those are called phosphatases. But kinases phosphorylate things. They add the phosphate to something. And if you remember what I talked about when we surveyed the functional groups, when I first talked about phosphates, even before we got to ATP, I gave you like four different absolutely vital functions of phosphate that all organisms need phosphate for, because it's a member of DNA, for instance, and so on. But one of those was that phosphorylation of things is a good way to act as a switch. You can activate proteins or deactivate them by phosphorylating or dephosphorylating them. Well, anyway, the enzymes responsible for phosphorylating proteins are called kinases. This kinase, cyclin-dependent kinase, is called that because even though it's an enzyme, it's in the off mode. It does not work as an enzyme unless it first binds to cyclin, a totally different protein. That's why it's called cyclin-dependent kinase. Okay? If it does get activated by cyclin binding to it, that will turn the enzyme on, and then it will be able to function as a kinase, which means it will be able to phosphorylate still another protein, which could be a different enzyme. Often is another enzyme. All right? But CDK by itself does nothing. Notice in the bottom picture, though, that CDK, cyclin-dependent kinase, is present during the entire cell cycle. It's always there. Cyclin, on the other hand, which is the part that has to bind to CDK to make it an actual working enzyme, is not always present at high levels in the cell. Look at the top graph again. This one purple here, labeled as cyclin concentration, it's normally low early in the cell cycle, and then it gradually increases. More and more cyclin gets created until eventually there's a high enough concentration that it becomes more and more likely that the cyclin will combine with the CDK that's been there the whole time. Now, if cyclin does bind to CDK, that entire complex containing CDK and cyclin is called MPF, as you see in the picture here. Another acronym. That MPF stands for mitogen promoting factor. Now, first of all, the word factor is used a lot in biochemistry. We'll see other examples of it even in this class. But when we use the word factor, we're really referring to a substance, and it's usually a protein. A substance that isn't there all the time, but if it is there, will cause something to happen that wouldn't happen without it being there. Okay? This mitogen promoting factor is just one of many factors. But mitogen promoting factor gets its name because a mitogen is something that causes, which is what gen means, like in generation or genesis, causes mitosis. A mitogen brings about mitosis. And therefore, this whole thing is called mitogen promoting factor because when it's in this form, in other words, the active form of CDK, the CDK will be able to phosphorylate some other enzyme, which will turn that enzyme on and allow it to do its job. Well, the enzymes that actually get phosphorylated by MPF, once MPF is complete, happen to be enzymes that are responsible for building microtubules. So this is how it spurs mitosis, because you have to build the mitotic spindle in order for mitosis to happen. That doesn't happen for most of the cell cycle because even though the CDK is there the whole time, the cyclin is not there, and therefore the CDK remains off. It becomes MPF only when cyclin is at high enough concentrations to bind to it. Does that all make sense? That's just one part of this control of the cell cycle, but it's as deeply as we're going to get into it in this course. All right, that brings us to 16. Speaking of factors, we have more factor. Another example of a factor here. This just continues a discussion of the control of cell cycle, but we're not going to look at it in molecular detail here. What we have here is some cells from tissue, some real human tissue in this case, that if you put these isolated cells from an organism in a petri dish with a medium, the medium is just the gel that it's on. If you supplement that medium with enough essential substances, the cells will remain alive. You're basically feeding them, and they will remain alive. Okay, that's the blue bottle here. Once they've separated the tissues into cells and plated them out onto minimal medium, as it's called, because it has just enough stuff to keep the cells alive and that's it, they will remain alive, but notice that they are not dividing. They're just living. On the other hand, if you give another bottle, you use exactly the same medium as the blue stuff, but then you add another ingredient, which is called PDGF. And that's an acronym that stands for platelet-derived growth factor. This is another use of the word factor. Platelet-derived growth factor is called that because we discovered it in platelets. But platelets are not the only places that it occurs. It's just always called that. Anyway, it's a growth factor, and growth factors, there's many different kinds of growth factors, but they spur some sort of growth. In this case, what PDGF does is tell these cells, start dividing. In other words, proliferate. Proliferate means to increase in numbers. So they don't just stay there living. they are spurred into mitosis and cytokinesis, and that's why you see many more cells here. Another indication of chemical control of the cell cycle. 17 is another example, but there's a couple new points here. Some cells, depends on the type of tissue, but some cells exhibit what is called anchorage dependence, meaning that if you had these cells just in liquid suspension, they wouldn't do well. They wouldn't divide. You could keep them alive if you gave them the right food, but they wouldn't divide just in suspension. But if you put them onto a surface, in other words, that's what the anchorage refers to. If they're anchored to something, they're stuck to something, that anchorage is a signal to them that they need to start dividing to create new cells. All right, that's the anchorage dependence. And notice they start with a small number, now you have more cells. So that's one thing, anchorage dependence. A separate thing, though, is what's labeled here as density-dependent inhibition. So these cells do get spurred on to dividing, but not forever. What's happening here is that when there is plenty of space around them and they are anchored, they will split, and the new cells will start filling up those spaces between them. But when they sense that they're connected to other cells, when all the space has been filled, in other words, then it turns them off. This is exactly what happens when skin heals. Right? If you cut yourself, you're removing some cells. The other cells are spurred, because they sense that empty space, into proliferating. They undergo cell division, but only to add in as many cells as are required to fill the gap. And then they stop. That's what happens normally. But cancer is not normal. Cancer is a genetic disorder, by which I mean it's a disorder of DNA, of the genes. That does not mean it's heritable. Not all genetic disorders are able to be passed on. It simply means it's a disorder of the DNA. Something has happened to the DNA. Well, DNA includes genes. Genes code indirectly for how to make proteins. And proteins do various things depending on the protein. But some of the proteins that cells are able to make are proteins that are involved in the control of the cell cycle. Proteins that we've been talking about. If damage to DNA, or it doesn't have to be damage, it could be for any reason, if a change in DNA sequence occurs, which is called a mutation, and it happens to occur to a gene that codes indirectly for how to make one of these proteins that are involved in the cell cycle control, then it's possible for the cell, because it makes now a different version, a mutant form of the protein corresponding to the DNA mutation, and that mutant form of the protein no longer works, the cell will lose control of the cell cycle. And one way it loses control is to think, so to speak, that it's supposed to divide over and over. It doesn't get the stop sign that these cells in density-dependent inhibition got. So that's why what you see here is just cells continue to divide even though all the space has been filled and they're accumulating. That is what a tumor is. All right. Now this happens originally in one cell that goes bad by mutation. But the problem is, the cell doesn't know it's bad. It just has different DNA because of the mutation. That's what a mutation is, change to the DNA. And so it undergoes cell division, which makes an exact copy. Now there are two cells that are both defective and don't know it. So they'll both think that they're supposed to quickly go through the cell cycle and divide. Now you have four. That's how a tumor develops. And that's what cancer is. So in 18 we see cancer occurring originally in a breast here, but it could be anywhere in the body. It depends on where the mutation occurs. Now, a tumor early on is really not interfering with anything. In fact, it's when it's one cell, which is what it starts out as, it's impossible to even detect, right? It's just a different version of a cell. By the time a tumor gets detectable, because it's big enough, it's many, many millions of cells, all of which are bad. And that even might not be causing any problems yet. But eventually it will get big enough that it starts interfering with the normal cells in the area, and they can't function properly. And that is when it becomes a problem. But this is why early detection is so important, because if you can detect it before it gets so big that you can't get it out or can't kill all the cells in it, then it can metastasize. Metastasis is much more serious, because that involves one or more of these cells in a tumor, which is the tumor is staying put. It's staying put. But it's made up of millions of cells. And some of these cells can just break off, for whatever reason, from the tumor, be carried by the bloodstream or the lymph to another organ in the body and start growing a new tumor there. That's what metastasis is. And therefore, that gets much harder to treat, and it also causes many more problems, because now it's interfering with a bunch of different organ systems at the same time. Is that the last slide? Yes, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
What's that? We're not done. We're just done with the chapter.
I know.
I didn't hear what you asked then.
Yeah.